Okay, good afternoon, everybody. It, according to my dad and Mai's time, is Tuesday at 3:18. By the way, Dad, whenever you call, you let me know what time it is, and I wonder if anybody does that with you.
No, I don't think so.
And do you wish they did? Do you wish people said, hi, it's Sean, and I'm calling at 12:15?
Not really. It's just one of my habits.
I like it.
It doesn't matter.
I like it.
Yeah.
I figure there's got to be a way that you could solve a murder mystery.
Yeah.
By how somebody leaves the time on the phone. Because there's actually, so I don't know if anybody listening knows this, but with watches, when you have what's called an automatic watch that doesn't need a battery, it has a certain number of hours before it winds down. And there was actually a murder solved when a guy was found at the bottom of a lake wearing a Rolex, because they could tell when the watch stopped that 48 hours prior is the last time he moved. Because that was the wind down time of the watch.
I see.
So they could figure out where he was, who he was with, and actually solve the murder based on the wind-down time of the watch. And I'm wondering if they, somebody could do that with your voice messages when you leave them. Yeah.
Well, I wonder now. This is, by the way, why I never bought a Rolex.
Yeah.
In case I commit a murder. So,
yeah, you can't kill anyone wearing one either, Dad.
Right. That's
You've
got to
kill either poor people or people wearing quartz watches.
The other reason was I couldn't afford a Rolex.
Yeah, there you go. By the way, I'm using a new microphone this week, everybody. I got one for Christmas. And this is actually, believe it or not, Dad, the first podcast I think we've done since Christmas.
Is it really?
I think so. It's been a while because I went on vacation and then you went on vacation. And we'll get into all of that in a sec. The part of the reason I got the new microphone, everybody, is because I was using two different kinds of microphones. And I'm pretty sure you might have noticed that my voice was a little bit quieter, which I didn't mind because this is more featuring my dad. But sonically, it's still an imbalance. So, Dad, tell me about the trip you just went on. You just got back from a cruise. Oh. And to those tuning in, this is called Conversations with My Father. And it's season two. It's the special drop of season two of Chatting Between Takes, my podcast that this is under. And I'm chatting with my 91-year-old dad, Eugene, and he just got back from a cruise. Tell me all about it, Dad.
Well, it was. It all began. I was sitting where I'm sitting right now. And I was just eating my dinner on a cold winter night. And I thought, why am I sitting here eating my dinner on a cold winter night in Toronto? I should be some other place. And where I thought to myself, where should I be in the sun? I should go on a cruise. And I said, absolutely. So I started looking up cruises, found one. And then I said, well, I can't go by myself, so I phoned a very dear friend and said, would you like to go along? And she said, absolutely, I'd love to go along. And so we set off, went to Florida, boarded ship down there and headed out to a place called Blue Cay or Blue Key.
Yep.
They call it C-A-Y, spell it there. And then from there on to Curaçao and Aruba and the Panama Canal and Puerto, what was it, what the other?
Costa Rica you went to? Yeah.
Costa Rica and then sailed around there and had lovely 10 days and back again. It was absolute delight because the thing I liked about it was I had a great chance to talk because normally I'm in my apartment and I'm by myself, so it's nice to get out.
Well, so let's talk a bit about that. You can have days in here on end where you might not leave if it's really cold in the winter and you're not really interacting with anyone but the concierge.
Right.
That must get a little lonely.
It does, actually. It does get lonely. And so that's why I went down there. And so I could meet people, you know, from a wide variety of life. One of the most interesting ones was I went out one day on the deck and took a deck chair and sat down and a lady joined me. And she was from Florida, actually. She was black, about, I would say, 70 years of age.
Okay.
And so we started chatting. And what I found very interesting was that as we talked along, a segregation came up.
Okay.
And for the first time, I was in a position because of the, you know, we're sailing in the sea, we didn't know each other, we were introduced, we talked, got our names. And then I was able to ask her about segregation. I'd never been able to do that before because I'd never been with a black person like that. And she was very frank. She said, from the age of 3, and she began to recount that. So all her life, for 70 years, she had experienced segregation in one form or the other.
Wow.
Right down to the present day. And so that for me was most interesting, to be able to talk to someone and she knew that I wasn't, you know, I think age is a kind of a thing that they know I'm not trying to be hurtful. And so I was able to enter doors that I never would have been able to enter before. Well,
this is interesting. A friend of mine just had a conversation with a fella about that age who's an actor, and this person was describing an experience. It's not my story to tell, so I won't be specific, but my friend just went, oh, that's just racism. And the older gentleman said, thank you for saying that, because so few people want to go at the center of that. And I also think, being Canadian, we have a very different history with that. So, I mean, she probably appreciated that, you know, just that you're not coming at it from a my side, your side, which I think is entrenched in the U.S.
After what I met another person from on that cruise, who was a man, and he said, oh, he said, Canadian. He said, I was up in Montreal. And he said, I was amazed, because he was also black. And he said, there was no segregation there. I could go anywhere I wanted, he said, because I come from the deep south. And he said, it was marvelous to have that feeling of being able to go where I want, go to the toilets, because he said, I remember when toilets were segregated, back at the bus stop. He said,
it's,
all of
it's
that.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. Yeah. And when you think about it, too, you know, it's so funny that you get these people, and especially right-wing pundits and stuff, who say, you know, you got to get over it. There's no slaves today. And you're like, I don't think you understand. There was segregation in people's current lifetimes, yet you've got your right-wing pundits who are like, we need to be able to fly the Confederate flag from 1863. Yep. Like, they haven't gotten over losing the Civil War, but apparently people of color are supposed to get over the fact that in their lifetime they were beaten or abused, or at the very least segregated, and there's still systemic racism. We know this.
Yep. So much of that was, I mean, is fresh in my memory. I can still remember Kennedy ordering the National Guard in against George Wallace, you know, in Alabama, right. I think he was the governor, in order to allow black students to have university education.
Like, you need a National Guard to enforce literally a group of presumably wonderful people the ability to get an education.
Exactly.
Your lifetime.
And you see
and you weren't young at that point. We're not talking 1928. We're talking the 60s.
We're talking the 60s. Yeah. So I remember this as vividly, because for me that's only 40, 60 years. Mm. And out of 90, that's nothing. I can remember being horrified and say, what's going on there? Now, the other thing to remember is that here you see the fissure, the break in society, because as they were beating down the police, beating down the black people, trying to get the rights in the southern states, Alabama, etc., over in the West Coast, the most liberal society you can have. Right. So that's the cleft in American society.
It's so interesting, that cleft, because a lot of people talk to me about, you know, I don't know if I want to go to America. I don't know if I want to go to Los Angeles for pilot season. And I go, you know what? New York and L.A. aren't really America. Like, they are. And in fact, they fundamentally drive everything culturally that we perceive that isn't grassroots. But the cumulative number of people who live in each city allow them to create their own island type of vibes. Yeah. When I'm in Los Angeles, I don't feel the same as, you know, being in Virginia or being in Texas.
Right.
And
the best of America is, in my opinion, the best of the world.
Of course.
I really mean that. If you compare civil liberties for most people in the United States, compared with, say, in Britain, the Secrets Act in Britain is far more draconian than anything in the United States.
Right.
You could never close down Canada, as Trudeau did, you know, 40 years ago when he invoked the War Measures Act.
No, you'd have militias rising up across the country.
We would have had the Supreme Court in the United States, Lawyers Association, they'd have blocked that right away.
Right.
But Trudeau got away with it. You know? So there you go.
So going back to your cruise idea, chatting with this lovely woman on the deck, my friend Tamir has the first question. Now, if you're listening, this isn't really a Valentine's Day edition, because it's actually 4 days later. But when I had posted that we were going to do the podcast, I had forgotten some gear that was essential to recording it. So your questions came in on Valentine's Day. So Tamir has a question, which is, you know, his grandfather was in his 90s and was very capable and able, just like you. And he, as a widower, ended up going to sort of dance nights. And he ended up having five or six, you know, lady partners, aged from 60 into the 90s. And then he'd become social with them, play chess or whatever. Have you considered that kind of thing, especially in the heyday of apps and dating apps? And I met my girlfriend on Hinge, the dating app. Have you considered any form of dating or at the very least active socialization with women, platonic or otherwise?
No, not really.
No?
No. Part of that is because I've got very close to family,
yep.
And because there's a large family in Ormond's side, you know, yep. through Dion and all that sort of thing, that all these birthdays and dinners and occasions that they have, I find those very, very satisfying.
Yeah.
And I haven't felt any need, nor do I want to reach out to even platonic relationship like that there. No.
Sure.
I'm okay. And I don't think I'm... I don't think I want that. Why? Because I don't. Yeah.
So even when you're having lonely times here, you're not like, I wouldn't mind going being part of a social group or anything like that.
Not really. That may come in the next 10 years from now. Maybe I want to do that. You see. but not right now. And I'm not quite sure why not. I think probably because I do still try to do a lot of writing, and I love TV, and I pick up my programs fairly carefully. And so and I don't want to allow myself to be maudlin, you know, with what you lose. Just carry on.
No, I get that. And then this is a bit of a pivot, but were you ever part of any like social groups like in the 60s, like men's groups or a chess club or a...
No, I was a loner in that sense, although I was very social.
Yeah.
I mean, I never would have belonged to Kiwanis or things like that there. I wasn't a club person like that, although paradoxically, I was a very social person.
Right. Yeah. And was that a conscious choice? Did you sort of look down at those things or look at them as...
No, they weren't my style.
Yeah.
I much preferred one-on-one relations, and rather than going to, say, a club where there's 50 or 60 people around, or even, you know, 10 or 12, a book club meetings, all that sort of thing.
Right.
Wasn't my bag.
Yeah.
And also, Mom and I had a very, we would... have tremendous conversations at nighttime, listening to music, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So it was very, very good that way, very dense.
You felt satiated in terms of your time with people.
Exactly, with people.
And you were part of a lot of committees and a lot of
committees
things like
and
that.
I was so busy in my life too, you know.
Yep.
With Writers Union and Penn and teaching university, all that kind of thing. Yeah.
Right on. So here's another Valentine's Day question. This one's from Anaïs. This is my girlfriend.
Yep.
And she says, "Oi, Jen, what was your favorite Valentine's Day? And then what did you generally do for Valentine's Day?" And you can go back into the 20s. I mean, how did you do Valentine's Day in Ireland? And, what did you do? Was there a thing?
Well, that's the interesting thing is I did very well on Valentine's Day because we didn't have a Valentine's Day in Ireland.
Okay.
It was not celebrated there. When I grew up, there were so many days that were not celebrated, such as Father's Day and Mother's Day and Valentine's Day. Christmas and Easter, yes. They were nearly always ecclesiastical holidays, funny enough, in Ireland, St. Patrick's Day, of course. And I think it was because many of these were a Madison Avenue events.
Sure.
Organized. And so when Madison Avenue said, you got to feel happy today, you got to love your girlfriend and all that sort of stuff for your wife. Well, I mean, it seemed to me you didn't need to say that. Although maybe it's a good thing to say it and bring roses.
You know, when I was younger, in my 20s, I had a very anti... establishment vibe. You know, I don't know if you remember that. It wasn't a huge thing, but you know, I grew up enjoying like the Woodstock vibe.
Yeah, I
had sort of a bit of a hippie in me, and I was just like, you know, deconstructing these things that we're all supposed to take for granted.
Yep.
And I was really into the Huxley and the Orwell and that kind of way of looking at the world.
Right.
It wasn't not obvious. And so I remember for a while just being like, no, these holidays are imposed on us and it's a way for just industry to basically sheep us along. I've fully changed my opinion, even though I agree with you that there shouldn't be a day that you have to do this, but what a delight to just go, I'm going to get the roses and I'm going to make the reservation. And by the way, and then the next night she's going to do the same for me. And we actually get two gorgeous, you know, fully developed Valentine's days while knowing that this is in no way a replacement if we don't feel this way on a random Thursday.
No, well, I must say I got sucked in too because it ended up, I went off and I got my dozen big roses and again, Renata was sucked in because she loved it. She said, oh, it's so nice of you to remember.
It is. Well, that's it.
Why wouldn't I remember the million-dollar industry pumping it at me for the whole week before? No, I think ultimately the idea is a very nice one. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, also, you know, there's that, I don't actually mean what I'm about to say, but there's that idea in relationships, you can be right or you can be happy.
Yeah,
so
right.
You know what, you can sit there and actually deconstruct how the holidays made up by Madison Avenue, and you can do all that, and you're right, you're probably right. You could probably trace the day that Coca-Cola designed Santa Claus, or you can just go, yeah, I get all that, but I'm going to go get some really nice roses and, you know, have a lovely night with my lady or my gentleman or my person.
Exactly.
And why not just – and I love it because it's funny. I mentioned the Orwell thing, but at the end of Big Brother, the end of the book, I'm pretty sure it says he loved Big Brother.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's the last sentence, but it's one of the last sentences. Yeah. And there is a bit of a like – you know, it's not that bad to give in to the flow, to what's happening. Unless you have a true ideological or it's hurting you in some way, it can be pretty nice.
Well, it's like this, you know, the Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
You're kidnapped, and after 6 months in that basement, while the guy reaches out a bit of food to you, then you begin to fall in love with the guy up there. Well, you did a movie in that theme.
Oh, I've done a few of those. I've made my career playing people who, you know, offer kindness after abuse. But in any case, it's true. We could call that the sale. When the when you get the sale on the roses, you feel loved. Here's a side note. The question's going in another direction, not Valentine's Day. And this is from my friend Sam Bennett. So I lived with him and Monica in Los Angeles. I was subletting with them in Silver Lake. Now, this is a bit of a story behind it, but when you live with people and then you don't see them at work, you sometimes just go, oh, cool, these people are great. We chatted. You know, Monica's a choreographer and a dancer, and Sam's a director and an editor and a writer, and we're just chatting in the living room a bunch. And then one day, they're like, hey, you want to see the video we just did? Monica choreographed it and Sam directed it. And I'm like, yeah, of course, I'll watch your video. And it ended up being the Phineas video for I Lost a Friend, which I've sent you, Dad, and I know you love the song.
Yeah.
And I love those moments where you've been hanging out with someone for a couple months, you get along great, and you go, holy fuck, these people are talented. They're not just talented, they're world-class talented. And I love that stuff. It's super fun when you go, oh, I just took for granted the fact that I'm living with true, real artists. Well, and have you ever had any experiences like that, Dad, where you're just sort of randomly chatting with someone and you're like, oh.
Well, I had one like that yesterday.
What was that?
That was a friend of mine going back almost 60 years, Charles Wilson, who died 10 months ago. And he wrote an opera. I wrote three operas with him.
Yep.
But this one I didn't. It's called Kamouraska, based on a novel by a wonderful French-Canadian writer called Annie Bear. And as I say, he died 10 months ago, but already on the boards had been slated to bring a revival of that opera back again. And I saw it yesterday, on Sunday rather, with his family here in Toronto, who staged again. And as I sat there, I suddenly thought to myself, like you, wow, I was with a guy and he has so much talent. He was a wonderful composer, and what a pleasure it was, and what an honor. You know, it was just wonderful to see all of that again now that he's passed away, now that it's up there again, that the work lives on. And it was great to have known him.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And even so many times, I might not have recognized how talented he was, but on Sunday, I just thought certain passages came along, and I thought, that's great art, and I was glad to be associated with that guy.
Oh, you that's know? Beautiful. Yeah. And also, I love that, because when you're collaborating with someone, you don't always appreciate what they're doing, because that's the whole point of collaboration, is you have a vision, they have a vision, and a lot of times, I don't know how it was with you and Charles, but you're butting heads.
Yep.
You know, Kobe and I in Analog Smith, we used to fucking scream at each other, yell at each other. We get really mad. And, you know, Phil and I didn't have the same dynamic. We would work more easily, but Kobe and I would get a lot of good work out of our frustration with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good with it. I don't mind working that way as long as we all understand the goal. But then you step back and you I see him in his new band, and I go, holy fuck, I think I forgot how good a singer he is.
Oh, you know, I know him. Wonderful
singer. Yeah, and so I'm glad you got that.
I had the same thing in the history of anybody who collaborationist in music. I'm thinking of Gilbert and Sullivan. I'm thinking of Strauss and his librettist, Hofmannsthal. They fought like cats and dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. But oh, so what?
I think so, what, too. I actually don't think that artists... in the modern idiom, and I can't remember, I don't think it was Peckinpah, but one of the famous 70s directors was saying that there's too much emphasis placed on being a nice guy these days.
Oh.
And there's not enough emphasis on what you're bringing to the table. Be a nice guy, but that's not the point. He was talking about Dustin Hoffman, and he goes, I would never enjoy the process.
Yeah.
But I would work with that guy again in a heartbeat because of what we did with the process.
Right.
And I buy that. I mean, not everything has to be banging your head against the wall, and I'm not going to address any of Dustin Hoffman's potential sexual stuff, which, you know, he doesn't even really defend himself from. He's just like, whatever. So I think he's wrong in that regard. But as far as the edginess of acting or any kind of artistic endeavor, I get that some people want to feel safe, and that's cool, but I personally am hoping to be pushed.
Yeah. Oh, you should be pushed. If you're not being pushed, nothing's happening.
Yeah,
nothing's happening. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, too. And also, you know, I mean this, like, physically I don't feel unsafe around a lot of people, but I kind of want to feel unsafe emotionally because it'll thrust me into a new category. And I think that's a bit of it. Like, if somebody's really been traumatized or whatever, no. I don't think you really want to dance with that. Or maybe you do and you create something brilliant, but you kill yourself. And I don't think that's worth it. But I do think going, okay, I have no idea what's going to happen next in this collaboration.
Yep.
Like, I'm looking for a director to throw me off my center.
Yeah.
Because my center's not the place from which I think I'll do my best work.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's really all I'm getting at.
I agree. Yeah, I agree, absolutely.
Now, let's get back to Sam's question. Any thoughts on this quote by Carl Jung? Until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate.
That's a good one.
What do you think of it? Talk about it.
Yeah. Read it for me once more.
Well, I'll read it for you four times.
Okay, right. That's a deep one.
That's a deep one. Until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. My dad's making notes right now.
Yep. Well, I would say that is true. That is true.
I love that you haven't heard this quote.
I have.
Sam, my dad's heard every quote in the world except for this one, apparently. And it's not like we're trying to do gotcha podcast here.
No.
But I think we gotcha.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one because, in a sense, it goes back to that whole era when they discovered, you know, the power of the unconscious, Freud, Adler, Jung, et cetera, and there they discovered and postulated that, in fact, there is so much of our lives that is controlled, and this is a commonplace, is controlled by the subconscious or the unconscious.
Yeah.
And that was their revelation. Now, whether to turn around and say that if that isn't uncovered, then that's your fate is a rather subtle question, which...
What do you think? Not what are these guys, what did they postulate? We got the quote. We know who Carl Jung is.
Yep.
What is your experience with that? Do you care about the subconscious? I mean, there's even a joke that Irish are impervious to therapy.
Yeah.
So, does any of this resonate with you? He's asked it to both of us, but I'll give my thoughts after.
No, actually, I think that my life has not been dominated by my subconscious or my unconscious. As I've said to you before a number of times, I think I am working out a pattern in my life that is already predetermined, that is set out there in some mysterious way, and in some way, while one might call that predestination, it also goes along with, here's the contradiction, it runs parallel with free will. And that is the irreconcilable question that comes up in philosophy, which ultimately says you can have both, and I say you can.
Okay, but we know that from prior podcasts.
Right.
But interestingly, an argument could be made right now that you're proving his point.
Yep.
Because you have decided that everything is written.
Yep.
In other words, you've decided that you are walking the path of your fate.
Right.
Mm. And you have never delved into your subconscious.
Never.
Right. So you conceivably could be a living example of Jung's quote.
I could be. Now, when you say I've never delved into my subconsciousness or unconsciousness, I would say probably that's not correct, because I think if you're a writer or you're thinking in any deeper level than the normal kind of thing, I'll go downtown,
sure,
that you are dipping into there. And certainly in my writing, I've noticed certain patterns that have come up quite often, and that those mean that I have been dipping into that bucket of the unconsciousness.
Sure. I don't think that's wrong. I mean, I know in my life that I had to go and still continue to go in and out of therapy,
yep,
and also my 12-step, so that there's another person helping guide, because a broken computer can't fix itself. And as such, I don't know that my unconscious is something that my conscious can do the journey of without someone going, this is what this is. This is what this looks like. These are replicatable patterns in the human condition that, yeah, you're actually stepping into. And then when you, and then when that starts to reshape, reframe, this is only my experience, by the way, but it's been life-saving. So I stand by it for myself. But in any case, I really love the quote. And, you know, yep, I don't know if you know this, but Jung was fundamentally the therapist, I'm not sure he was quite a therapist, but the thinker in terms of the unconscious who most guided 12-step. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of the shadow self.
Oh, yeah, that
and the whole idea of doing an inventory of yourself and facing your own darkness, essentially. Yep. And until you face that darkness, it will run the show.
Yeah. He seemed to me to have been the kind of philosopher of Freudianism, taking all the scientific stuff that Freud was putting out there, and he was a great scientist, and it seems to me that Jung was the one who was the philosopher behind that, taking those ideas and making a system that was much more spiritual, because he wasn't a scientist in that, right, same sense as Freud.
Well, now what's interesting is the founder of AA worked with him and came back to the States with all this knowledge.
Yeah.
And he's like, I now understand my unconscious. And then he kept getting drunk.
Yeah.
And
getting drunk.
Correct. And so that sort of led to the phrase, self-knowledge will avail us nothing.
Yeah.
And in fact, until we surrender to something that can then, you know, be a power greater than us. I'm basically giving everybody a window into 12-step. Only is that power greater than ourselves great enough to deal with the problems we're facing that we think naming them will end it,
yeah,
but it doesn't. And so that, Sam, by the way, if you can't tell, I agree with that quote entirely for the reasons I just stated, is that,
right,
you know, when you sit there and you go, I'm the kind of guy who dot, 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 there's two versions of surrender. One of the versions of surrender is, so fuck it, that's just who I am, that's my fate.
Yeah.
And we know those guys or women or people. But also there's the people who go, I think I'm this kind of thing. I need help navigating this, i.e. uncovering the unconscious, because I don't think I can ever uncover my unconscious myself. It'll be revealed through art, I agree with you, and your writing, but I don't think until I take a guided journey through it, and there's multiple ways to do that, that I'm actually going to be anything but subject to my childhood wound.
But there are so many other ways that people aren't aware of which you get that total surrender, reaching out for the other. And for most people, I find it most interesting, is that it is the one saving factor in human life, which otherwise is a pretty much messy, fearful, painful thing,
No, you don't need to lean in. I'll adjust it for you.
Is the fact that...
Okay, now I got to turn it down.
That nature makes us fall in love. The male,
right,
seeking the female.
Right.
And that astonishing act of falling in love is a surrender.
Correct.
You give yourself over to the other person. Now, in that particular moment, that is quite wonderful. And that is, in a sense, how would I say, an unconscious surrender to the unconscious.
Now, I agree with you. However, I want to unpack that a little further. What about the idea that you... Okay, so whatever you think of Marianne Williamson's presidential campaign, she has one of my favorite quotes on the planet, which is that my childhood wound will always trump my highest and best thinking, but my higher power will always trump my childhood wound. Mm-hmm. I buy that.
I buy that too.
Exactly.
Yep,
so
I buy that too.
If you haven't surrendered to a higher power other than the woman or man or person you're aspiring to be with, then there's a good chance that that aspiration to be with them is a function of your childhood wound. And I believe that there's two versions of love.
I utterly believe that.
I think there's a version of love that we call love, and we think we're fated to be with someone.
That's a human love we're talking about.
Correct. Yeah. And we're essentially trying to fix ourselves and fix our childhood. But if we're not coming from a place of essentially in a fixed or fixing process, we're going to choose a partner who replicates the very damage that was ever done to us. And similarly, the other person is maybe doing the same with us. And as such, our wounds meet, not our authentic best selves meet. And as and then we replicate the thing we don't love. And I've even talked about this. I mean, look, there was an unavailability with mom. You know, she the nights where she would drink, you've got this person who's 100% there and then not there.
Yeah.
For me. Well, look at the women I've dated who are 100% there and then there's an unavailable aspect to it. That would be a perfect example of a replication of the type of female energy mm-hmm. that I need to work on fixing if I'm going to find a fulfilling relationship with somebody who's going to be ultimately reciprocal in a way that I call love.
Well, you see, there is the other side. Maybe I should have completed that after what you're saying. I could see that it was, I think it was Socrates or Plato, one of the two of them, talked about that the unexamined life is not worth living.
Sure.
And so, you, unfortunately, and I'm not saying this disdainfully, that for most of people too, although they could fall in love, they are not in a position to actually examine their life because that 90% of human beings are tied so dreadfully to their jobs and putting bread and milk or whatever, water into the mouths of their family, they have no time to think. They work, they stagger home, they get in, fall asleep in bed, get up the next morning at 5 o'clock, and they are slaves to the great industrial
Absolutely.
Machine all around us. And to say that they should examine their lives, they haven't even a chance to think about it.
Yeah.
And so that's been all they all have it. All of everybody has it when they're born, that light, that
yes.
business
yes.
of aspiration
yes.
That we all share,
yep.
an intellectual, poet, saint, blah, blah, blah. But that light is smothered in most people and they're left to trudge their way through life except for the one affirming flame, which is love. But the examination is not there.
So what about someone who loves an abuser? They love them. They've surrendered. They've well, surrendered more than most of us. And
right.
then they're getting beat up or they're getting psychologically abused. Is that love?
Well, you know, curiously, I remember years ago reading about the fact that it was a form of love to actually be in love with a husband or a lover who beats you up.
Of course, it's a form of love.
And they would.
Do you call that love?
And I don't call it love.
I call that like addictive type behavior. I call that replication of wound. That's the kind of thing that I don't call love.
Yeah, and yet this was the American Psychological Association, whatever it was called.
Oh, sure.
And they were saying that this is a form of love.
Now, well, just like the Stockholm Syndrome you mentioned.
Right, yeah. It's dreadful you think of it. But, I mean, for that person, that's what they grew up with.
Yeah.
I've spent 20, 30 years being abused, and that's why they don't pick up the phone and call the police.
And you know? And that's what that is why I do agree with Sam's quote, is that if you haven't dug into the unconscious
yep.
need
yep.
to love someone who hurts you, and now I don't mean physically, although it yep. includes that,
yep.
then there's a good chance that you're going to be fated to find someone who hurts you, and then you're going to call it fate. This is my man, this is my woman, this is my person. Mm-hmm. But it actually didn't need to be.
Right, that is true. It didn't need to be.
So it's not, and fate, pardon me, Dad, I just interrupted,
yep.
but the definition of fate would be that which needs to be.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
And so
right.
I don't think you need to be with that person.
But the thing is, when you're now taking, you're looking at step number two, that person, because they have met the abuser,
yeah.
that was always meant to the cards.
Look, I was just going to even yeah. say, if you're Eckhart Tolle, you say, of course they needed to, because they did.
Yep, because they did.
Valid.
Right.
But if you go Schrodinger's cat on it, before the future happens,
right, yeah.
you don't need to love the person who's going to hurt you.
But the damn
and
thing,
then call it fate.
Yeah.
But when you open the box, it's either or.
But the thing is, very often, if you look at where the person comes from, their income level, their socioeconomic
sure.
background, that person is condemned to the conditions to how that world operates, and that could be the world of drink, drugs, etc.
Sure,
and so they're stuck with that.
I agree with that. I would use the idiot who's president of the United States as an example of the fact that you can have just as much damage as a privileged person.
Oh yeah,
because that's one of the most psychologically damaged people I've ever seen on display,
yep.
And always has been. And as his dementia gets worse, there's less of a cover for it. He's not the clever 80s tycoon anymore. He's the 2020 basically sundowner fella. Yes. In any case, the point is that guy had every privilege in the world. He could have done all the self-reflexive work of the world. He quite literally, based on whatever wound his dad and mom gave him, plus life, he's as bad psychologically as anybody.
Well, studies have been made, as you know,
oh, yeah.
of world leaders.
Yeah.
And they say in nearly all cases, they are psychopathic personalities.
Well, you can't want that job without being one.
Yeah, right. And I mean, Churchill, so many people hold him up, Reverend the great Churchill. Well, I mean, he was a great colonizer.
Yeah.
Literally, but with the Indians, said we're in this subcontinent, but now, what is it, 1 billion people, China, 2 billion.
Yeah.
And he said, those people led by a naked fakir called fakir, I'm saying, not the other word, F-A-K-I-R, Gandhi. And he said, no. And the dreadful abuse he poured upon them until they finally got under a different prime minister altogether.
Yeah.
And yet they hold him up as a hero, many people. I mean, it was a psychopath.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with that. I don't think you can want that job without having a certain level of that.
Mussolini, Stalin, you know, Hitler, all of these dreadful people. So you have to be some form of that.
Absolutely. So talking about power, let's jump into a question I have, and it's based on what we talked about the other day, where you wanted to get this article implemented, and you were having trouble getting a response from the Alumni Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And so I want to ask you about this in your life, but generally if you agree with this idea. And what my dad and I were talking about is he was having trouble getting a response from some people at an Alumni Magazine to promote his book, and it wasn't a big deal, but they were just not really attending to his emails for a while. And I said, you know, Dad, it's interesting because in Los Angeles, essentially there's two kinds of power, assuming you're not, you know, foisting yourself on someone physically. And one is your money. You got the money, you got the $80 million, you've got the mansion in Bev Hills. That equals power. That's buying power. That's people treat you well. They want what you have. But the other power that I contend is more valued in Los Angeles is, can you show up at the hottest restaurant in town Saturday night at 8:30 with no reservation and get seated right away? That to me is the real power, because that's not just currency, that's current.
Yeah.
How do you find aging and the loss of that power feels?
Well, curiously, I find that with aging, I get all sorts of other powers.
Okay, I love this.
People are always getting up from their seats and giving it to me.
Right.
People always say, can I help you? So, and if I phone in and I'm paying, say, a parking fine, and I say, I'm having some difficulty, and the normal thing is, will you just go and you do this and this? And I'll say, well, I still am having some difficulty because I'm 91.
They'll right.
say, let me take care of it.
Yeah.
And so all of that sort of stuff. Just give me the wonderful power that comes from age. Now, you might say, well, what about a different kind of power?
Sure, the one I'm talking about.
But the one
get the guy on the phone immediately. It's Eugene Benson calling, and they go, don't care.
Well, the thing about that is that I'm beyond that, because I don't need that power, that kind of power anymore. What do I need it for?
To get your article in.
Yeah, well, on that particular detail, I'm just dealing with, a bureaucracy, and I realize that there's no malice there.
So that's the same frustration if you were 40 and you were dealing with a bureaucracy.
Exactly.
That has nothing to do with a diminished sense of value in the world.
None whatsoever.
Right.
None whatsoever.
So you find that the way you're treated as an elder statesman essentially is the transition, and you've allowed it to happen.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's actually a compliment I want to give you, because I do find that you've aged very gracefully that way.
Yep.
And you've let yourself walk more slowly.
Yep.
And you've let yourself need the help where needed.
Yep.
And I even noticed the photo you chose for that article. Lovely photo, by the way. It's my dad on the back porch at our old house. It's not a photo where you look unduly young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really wonderful choice. I thought, wow, he's really just... this is who you are,
yeah.
And you know it.
When my book came out, my memoir,
Symmetry of the Tiger, which, by the way, you can buy on Amazon in some bookstores, and also was initially the impetus for this podcast. We're well beyond that, and we even were halfway through podcast one, but go buy Symmetry of the Tiger.
Right. Well, you see there, the photograph in that is of a young man, 45 years of age.
Was that the one from Niagara Falls? Is that the one we did?
That's the one, Niagara Falls, we did that. But then on this one, I thought, well, put what I look like now.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful choice.
And I took that choice, you know why? Because I look twice as handsome and three times more intelligent. Joke over.
This is good, Dad. You just qualified us for the comedy podcast on Podomatic and all our aggregators, because somehow I'm still listed that way. Yeah, what would our podcast be, Dad? It's not quite philosophy. Would it be philosophy? What would it be? What would it be? Home and Garden?
No, I would say...
Home and Garden?
Educated Chat.
Educated Chat. Let's yeah, one of us. I'm not going to say which one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, see, we're getting really funny now.
Yeah.
Okay, Aimé Puthon, Dad. I love this question. It's a very sort of lovely nostalgic type
Aimé,
of question.
One of my favorite people. Yeah. Wonderful, lovely woman.
Woman, and she was the broker on our house sale, and just really took care of us. So I don't
and
know.
Her grandfather was a fawn, like how would you say, a member of the nobility. And he ran the Salzburg Music Festival, Sound of Music.
He did that?
Yeah, for
that's cool.
About close to 30 years, he ran that great festival.
Do you think he ever met Christopher Plummer?
Let me see. He would have. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah?
He would have, because now Christopher, that was about 60, was it?
The movie? I'd have to look it up. But
anyway, it doesn't matter, but he might have. Yeah. Anyway, that was Aimé. Hi, okay. Aimé, how are you?
So her question is, what were your favorite buildings, parks, etc. around Guelph, and why?
Well, St. George's Park, I loved. That was beautiful. Right on our doorstep, walked up there 2 minutes, and there was this beautiful park right there on the doorstep.
Yeah.
And what I loved about that park, to be more precise, was they had a tennis court, and it was free.
Yep.
And there I used to be able to play tennis with my friends, and there is where I taught my older son, Ormond, and my interlocutor, my... interrogator here, Sean. I taught him to play tennis up there.
Yep.
So that was a wonderful, wonderful park.
Yep.
Now, the other thing I loved too was the Church of Our Lady in Guelph, which is now a basilica. And there was this beautiful church. This beautiful church on a hill overlooking the entire city, the Catholic Church. Built, you know, I mean, it's a beautiful thing to the Cologne Cathedral. Built on that kind of look.
Which was Mum's favorite city in Germany, by the way.
Right, indeed. She took a degree there. And so I loved that particular church. And then the Anglican church down there, St. George's, again, beautiful church.
Where I did my Cub Scouts.
Right. So what I loved, and the other thing about Guelph I loved, was that on a Sunday morning, the carillons would ring out from the church bells all over the city. It was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And that little town when we first went to it, 35,000, now about 120,000.
Yeah.
So those are my memories of what a beautiful city Guelph was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that park for me, I mean, you know, for those of you listening, basically, you know, this is the 80s, and me and my friends and my brother and his friends, we just go to the park. And there were laneways around, and you just bike up or walk up, and you bring your baseball mitt. And I mean, I can't remember how many things I've left in that park, and you go back and it's still kind of sitting there, and you come home for dinner when your parents yell out the front door, and especially my mom, you could hear her through the neighborhood if we were late for dinner, and then just go back out until 9 or 10 when it got dark. And I mean, what an existence. And the fundamental thing is it was safe.
Very safe. The other thing I love about it was there was a river running through Guelph called the Speed River, which in fact wasn't very speedy. It was very slow and casual. But there was, on it was a boathouse. Remember the boathouse?
I don't really remember. Oh, the one that they rebuilt.
That they rebuilt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Beautiful one, a kind of Rococo style, pinkish and all that.
Yeah.
And you could rent a canoe and you could paddle along in your canoe on the river. And really, with the restoration of that boathouse, you could just close your eyes or sort of shut out the cars going by and see yourself in sort of late 19th century Victorian setting. You know, it was beautiful, that little thing.
You could just drop into a city and be in any time period.
I used to always think of Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, you know, with the two girls down there and him punting on the river in England. Here it was in Guelph, you know, that river. Beautiful.
Do you think that was an odd relationship he had with her?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I think it was too. I don't think it was physical, but I think it was a male attraction to a beautiful young girl. Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, too young.
Too young.
Too young for that kind of attraction. Yeah. Mm. Brendan says hi. Cousin Brendo.
Cousin Brendo.
How you doing, Brendo? Nice to hear from you. He fundamentally says hi. And then he asks a question, which I really like. How do you reconcile the principles of moderation and satisfaction?
My goodness, that's philosophical.
This is where we're going with the podcast today. We got some juice going. Let's see if you and I agree or disagree on this one after our Jung fight.
Moderation and satisfaction.
Yeah.
Well, I'd be excited to say that they are rarely compatible. That sometimes moderation and what was the other one? And
satisfaction.
Sometimes they don't go together because if you're out for a night, and I can remember going out for many good nights, and they involved going to pubs and drinking and all that kind of thing. And if I had been moderate, I don't think I would have had as much satisfaction.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, balanced against that was an old dictum I had from the school I went to, the high school that I went to, where the staff, mainly priests, always said, stop when you still are a little bit hungry.
Yeah.
And that's very good advice. But I still am inclined to agree with Oscar Wilde when he said something like, you know, nothing succeeds like excess.
Yeah.
So that's where I feel on that.
Yeah.
Without being too serious in my answer.
Yeah. I mean, Brendo, I actually think I have the agreement with my dad. Look, actually, Brendan and I have probably had as many nights out as I've had with anybody. Yeah. We'd go out in LA all the time. Brendan, you were the best wingman, and I hope I was yours too. And then often he'd peel off to work, and then I'd go carry on for about 4 or 5 more hours when I shouldn't have. And it's funny because sometimes people, you know, now that I'm a moderate, obviously, with my behaviors, as in abstinent with booze and drugs, but also generally moderate with my, you know, I mean, I even saw a watch that I wanted the other day. And my God, I could have swiped the credit card and I just said, just wait. You know, and that's the kind of moderation that we find, I hope, especially if you've gone broke in your 30s and don't want to do it again in your 40s, you get smarter. In any case, Brendo, I kind of, you know, sometimes people will ask me, do you miss the drinking and the drugs? And the answer is not the drinking and the drugs, but I do miss the utter insanity of not having any clue what's going to happen when you leave that house at 7, 8, or 9 p.m. And there was something pretty insane about it all, genuinely, like, and it caused a lot of problems at times, but the satisfaction I wrested from it actually had to do with the insanity, with that feeling of like, I'm living and I have no idea what's going to happen next.
Well, you see, I would, a slightly more serious note for me, apart from the last answer, I think when you're young, that there is a natural vitality there. If you look at, for instance, a horse with its foal, and the little foal is out there kicking up its heels through sheer animal pleasure. And I think youth is associated with extravagance. And if you haven't had that in your life and you end up as an older man beyond middle age, and you look back and people say, now, did you ever get drunk or do you ever do this and this? And you say, no, never. I think you've missed something, that there is the high wine of youth and, you know, that 40s period, maybe it goes on to 50s, I don't know how long, but away you go. And I think that's a wonderful thing to have experienced.
Oh,
indeed.
You know, I agree. And I also agree in the sense that, you know, we've talked about this and we don't need to go too far down the path, but I think the idea of no regrets is ludicrous. I don't think you've lived if you have no regrets.
Yep.
And that goes a bit to what you're talking about. I get why people say it. I truly do.
Yep.
You wouldn't be where you are now if everything hadn't unfolded as it had, and therefore no regrets. Yep. No. Yep. I regret a lot of shit. And just like a bad tattoo and just like a scar, I don't want to necessarily get rid of it, but I also don't want to pretend that I don't have it.
You see, the thing is, there's an old saying, I think it's an old saying anyway, that as we get older, you know, our vices, we don't give them up. They begin slowly to desert us.
Yeah.
And then, with age.
Yeah. And then, Brendan, to go a little more serious as well, for me, the answer that is quite true is the word satisfaction we're using as a way to say get satisfied within a 4-hour period from when you hit the bar stool. Mm-hmm. But I actually think satisfaction is a deeper, you know, there's joy, there's woo, 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 there's rock star moments, But satisfaction is what I felt when I completed Barn Wedding. Mm-hmm. Satisfaction is what I feel when I'm done an 8-month gig or a song I've written, and that doesn't have a lot of woo-woo around it. That actually is a very quiet sense of, whew, this exists now, or this thing was completed and I did it with dignity and simplicity. And so, in fact, moderation and satisfaction, if we're looking at the exact words you used, they actually go hand in hand for me.
I would totally agree. Once you begin to examine the term satisfaction, it's much more than that high from alcohol, drunk.
That to me is the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. No. Satisfaction is a much, much broader concept than the narrow one I was using earlier.
Yeah. Well, I think that's how he meant it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if we're being semantic, then I have to say that satisfaction is a deeper sense of, you know, pride and accomplishment and whatever you want to call it. But if you're talking about pure, unabashed, like, woohoo, I don't even know if joy is the word. There's a million ways you can look at it, joy versus happy or whatever. But for those nights out, that kind of thing, I don't know if you can reconcile it, but I know if you're anything like me or it sounds like my dad, you hit an age where we go, yeah, that's not satisfying anymore.
Yep.
That ain't doing what it used to do.
Yep. But I still see it, you know, and I think it's good. It's good to have.
Well, it is good. But, you know, I remember with my cast on my last TV show, they're all early 20s. And then we're hanging out a lot. And on the weekends, they'd be like, hey, come on, we're all going to a supermarket in Toronto. Great bar in Kensington. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if my one-time friend Rob still owns it. But anyways, good stuff. Dance parties all night. These are people with dance backgrounds. I love dancing. And after about three times going, hitting around 1 a.m., I just had a little bit of a feeling of, I don't need to do this too many more times. I don't need to come here next week is more what I mean.
Exactly.
To be invited was more important than to be on the dance floor at 1:30 a.m., especially as people are starting to get a little drunk, a little high. They're starting to, you know, couple up with strangers. And, you know, I got my lady waiting at home and you know, I've had a good dance. And I'm also the fucking old guy on the dance floor, whether I like it or not. Because that's not a dance floor skewed. That's not the cruise ship dance floor, Dad.
No.
So let's go out on this because it's where we started.
Right.
Are cruise ships going to be boring as hell for young people? Or no? Or is that a myth?
I would say myself that cruise ships and young people, by and large, are incompatible.
Yeah. Go on.
Absolutely.
Go on. Go on.
Because...
I don't know why I just purred.
I purposely did not want to go on cruise. We said we'd save that up for later. For example, you could go to Europe, and they push it now, and some people love it. You get on a boat in some great city in Europe, and you paddle down or sail down the great rivers of Europe, etc.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's paddle boats anymore.
Not paddle boats. Yeah. No, they're not. And they're lovely, etc. But what I did for years and years and years, now you went to a lot of trouble, and that was I'd rented a car.
Yeah.
And I drove
drove
all over Europe from Berlin to Vienna to Lyon to Paris. I mean, all over. And that way I was able to get a good chance to meet the people, see the people, not, of course, fluent French and German, etc. So I love that sort of thing. And I said, I always had in mind a cruise.
Yeah.
And I said, but when we get older, we'll go to cruises.
Sure.
And so people might say to me, but we've only got 2 weeks. We don't have long holidays. You could still rent a car and do that kind of thing.
Oh, God, So that's when you want to rent a car.
So then it would be, I think it's better to postpone that sort of thing to later on, and maybe a special occasion, you go off for a week on a boat, but I would say no.
Yeah.
There's so many places
good to know.
That you go to. I mean, you go to a beach in the Dominican Republic, Mexico, or something like that, and you can swim, parasail, all of these activities where you're doing something like that rather than being on a boat. And, of course, the ultimate one, Madison stuff, is with the new big boat, 5,000 people, and then a crew of 2,500. So you're looking at well over 6,000 people, up to 7,000.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you know, go on this ship. You won't even know you're at sea. Now, I love that line.
Yeah.
Why would you go on a cruise where you don't even know? And it's true. They say the young people there, they've got all of these indoor games mountain climbing.
Right.
You know,
wow. Okay.
So you won't even know you're a sea shrubby. No, I'd say young people, no.
Yeah. Good to know. Oh, yeah. You. I mean, you know, I think we talked about this, like when I was in Morocco and we rented a car and we drove up the coast from Essaouira up to Casablanca and Rabat. I mean, that was half the fun was having to read a map in Morocco instead of just being brought to a place, being told where the tourist shops are, that kind of thing.
I mean, if you start going on cruises, I'll disown you.
Yeah.
You're a young man, so you should be.
Yeah.
I would say.
No, I got to get mine in town.
In 20 years, maybe you think about your first cruise.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear that. Well, Dad, this has been a wonderful chat. And people, keep the questions coming. We will post this one in the next couple of days.
Yep.
And then we'll do another one in a week or two.
Okay.
Anything you want to go out on, Dad?
No, it's fine. I loved it. I loved it. Hello to everybody out there who sent in the questions.
Awesome. Hello to everybody indeed. This has been Chatting Between Takes, Conversations with My Father, Season 2, Special Drop. Brap, brap.
Good.
Do you want to try the brap, brap, Dad?
Brap, brap, brap.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. Ow.
Just go back a little bit. Let me hear my voice to see how it sounds.
On the braps?
Don't mind. Just a little bit back.
Okay.